It seems like a good night to talk about the Dharma. And we can at least start going that direction. And at any time you all can't hear me, or if anything else goes weird, let me know.
Okay.
And this is really a bigger group than I had expected. So nice and cozy tonight too. Once again, as with all of the talks I try to give, this is, it owes a lot to Carol and talking over the breakfast table about Dharma topic of the week. Mm-hmm. And I've had some help from a new book by Adyashanti this week too, just clarifying ideas. None of these talks come in a vacuum. It's everything in the Dharma kind of reinforces everything else. And it's really interesting, as I was thinking back over teachings that I've received and things that I've read, it came to me that on the one hand, Buddhism seems to be all about awakening. And then at least as often, it seems like the teachings are all about suffering. And so what's going on here? On the one hand, it's like the blind man and the elephant, but in this case, a person could be introduced to Buddhism and think it's all about awakening or enlightenment. And another person could be introduced to Buddhism and get the idea that it's all about suffering, the causes of suffering, and the end of suffering. And it's not immediately obvious how these things go together. Seems to me that I could suffer less and still not be awake. So let's explore that tonight. Because indeed they go together. It's just not always obvious, but it helped me to understand how they relate. And as we all know, the Buddha describes his own awakening as an experience of interrelatedness, infinite interrelatedness and interdependence and ongoing change, everything evolving moment by moment by moment. So that was his own description. And he and teachers through the millennia have described that one can have an intuition of this. It grows, it's minuscule at first, and then it can grow. And for most of us, it takes, it's kind of an ongoing process, little glimpses, little hints, little intuitions, and then these build on each other. And these intuitions tend to be of the same thing, of this this vast connection, this vast feeling of interrelatedness and interconnectedness and interdependence and changing together, changing into each other, being formed by each other. And there's a sense of a vast loving intimacy involved in all of this. And we get the idea reading the old texts that we're supposed to suddenly have this epiphany and we're there. But for 99.9% of us, as we study and practice and mature and are supported by our Sangha, we get little glimpses of this. At first, we might not even recognize them for what they are, but we get little glimpses, little openings, little sensations of this vast, loving, holding intimacy, this interrelatedness. And it's not special to the Dharma. John Muir talked about how no matter what you look at, it's hitched to everything else in the universe. I love that description. Einstein had his own descriptions of it. Poets, people way outside of Buddhism have had this same experience. So the Buddha didn't describe something that is Buddhist. But it's related to we're conditioned beings. Our ordinary mind is conditioned by the survival needs of our species. That's normal. And so we are conditioned to view the world as self and other. And it's absolutely essential for survival, but it leads us to the pain of separation. The pain of being separate. So when we don't understand our true nature, when we don't recognize this true nature that the Buddha and others have described, not just here, but in our hearts, we suffer this pain of separation. And in this pain of separation, we are self and other. And when we're self and other, we are ruled by attachment to the things we want and aversion to the things we don't want. And so with attachment, there's dislike. I mean, there's liking and preference and clinging and grasping and pursuing and trying to get the goodies, gain and pleasure and praise. And then on the other hand, there's aversion, where we're trying to not get pain and loss and criticism. So we're caught in between. There's our true nature, which the Buddha and others have described as this vast, intimate connection without limit. And there's our conditioned mind, which splits into self and other, and with this split, there is suffering. And so, as we understand this, we start to see the connection between awakening and suffering. And you all have heard me clarify before, but we're not talking about pain. Pain is inevitable in living organisms. We're talking about suffering, where we don't just accept the pain, but we amplify it and try to push it away and try to avoid it and maybe have the pain of the second arrow, saying, oh, I'm a terrible Buddhist because X, Y, or Z, because I just had an argument with my friend or a fight with my roommate or whatever, or I really wanted that Mercedes so badly, you know. So the second arrow includes criticizing ourselves and self-dislike and self-hatred, and that leads to feelings of failure and, oh, I'll never be a good Buddhist and I might as well quit. So this pain of separation leads us to all of the things everyone in this room is intimately familiar with from all of your Dharma talks you've ever experienced and all of the books you've read. The pain of separation is painful because, number one, we suffer, and deeper than that, we're separate from our true nature. So recognizing this is the beginning of swimming up to the surface and getting a fresh breath of air. So our task is not to get rid of this ordinary mind. Our task is not to criticize ourselves a million times a day when we fall back into attachment and aversion. Our task is to recognize it as it arises. And two things can happen with recognition. We can start to see it at play and see our relationship to it. And then over time, the more we see it, the more we understand it, and the less we're ruled unconsciously by it. I'm not telling you a thing you haven't already heard, just maybe trying to reframe it in a different way. So we go through our days with the goal of recognizing whenever we have attachment or aversion, like or dislike, whenever we're in a fight, whenever we're feeling greedy. Identity is another way of looking at this. Whenever I'm attached to something, attached to a belief, and tying that belief to my identity, I am a libertarian. I am an environmentalist. I am a camper. I am a traveler. If we turn these things into a belief or a religion or an affiliation and tie that to our identity, then we are guaranteed to be in this pain of separation and this attachment and aversion and this suffering. Now, it's completely possible to have an affiliation without turning it into your identity. One could say, I enjoy camping. One could say, my voting habits depend on analyzing lots of different factors. These are ways of pointing out that we can have affiliations toward camping or toward liberal politics without it being our identity. We notice some of the ways we lean, but we're flexible. And if somebody challenges our loyalty as a progressive or our competence as a camper, we might see a little bit of welling up of defensiveness. And that right there is our teacher. So in this case, if things arise like that and we're conscious of them, then that's dharma. We're taking it on the road. We're learning from it. But if instead we're offended and defensive, and in our defensiveness get in an argument about, I am too a good progressive, and here's how I can prove it, then we're off to the races. We're not using it as the teacher. We're not gaining insights from it, and it's not dharma. So it's a very thin line. We can see these things arising and make them dharma, or we can be lost to them. And that's delusion and suffering. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes.
So there's two tasks here. One, and this is true for all of us at any stage in our dharma development. First of all, we need to recognize when these conditioned patterns arise. We can do that whenever we notice that we're resisting something. If we're resisting something, there's probably an identity or a belief behind that, a separation into self or other. Being in arguments is wonderful. Whenever we're in an argument, we're in a self-other separation. It's not bad. Can be. If we get in the knockdown, drag-out fight and make an enemy and hurt people, that's not good. But by itself, these separations aren't bad. It's just that either they're ignorant because we aren't aware of them, we're carried away by them. And if it's ignorant, then we're just lost in delusion, and it's not dharma, it's just ordinary life. Or we can start to recognize it, oh, I have resistance, oh, I'm defending, oh, I'm attacking. I'm in a fight. And then we know that we have started to separate there into self and other. Maybe we're fully separated, but if we can get a step back and see it and say, oh, this is how ordinary mind works. This is the pain of separation. Then it's clearer that there is an alternative. Arguments and fights are wonderful for Dharma practitioners. They're the best because there's not really any, I mean, when you're lost to it, you're lost to it. But basically, it's a pretty black and white situation. I'm in a fight. And I'm sure many of you have heard me say that one of my teachers once said, if you're in a fight, you're wrong. And I said, what do you mean I'm wrong? I'm not wrong. The other person was wrong. Anyway, so an argument or a fight arises. We can be lost to it, lost to delusion, not Dharma, or we can notice it. Even while the fight is going on, we can be noticing, oh, look what I'm doing. Oh, this is the pain of separation. What's the opposite of the pain of separation? It's what the Buddha talked about in his awakening. The vast, interdependent, loving, holding environment of intimacy and connection. That's the opposite. When we stray off the path, it's not necessarily bad, although it's the seeds of suffering. But we can make the arising of this separation Dharma because we recognize it and we see it and we're learning from it and we see the teaching behind it, or ignorance. Moment by moment choice, Dharma or ignorance. And that's our path, on the cushion and off. Fall down, get back up. Fall down, get back up. Fall down, get back up. And here's where the second arrow is the killer, because self-criticism comes in, self-dislike, self-denigration, it just slips in. It's how we are. So we also have to be aware of that. Every time we have a thought, I'm a bad Dharma practitioner, or I'm a bad person, or oh, I'm a failure, or I'll never get this. That second arrow, really crucial we see it, because it's an even more valuable teaching for us. Oh, look what I do to myself. Self-harm. How can you be a good Dharma practitioner without falling down and getting back up and falling down and getting back up and falling down and getting back up? I don't know any way to do it otherwise. Only way I've ever learned anything in my life is by mistakes. Okay, any questions on any of that? I think that's it for the talking tonight. It's a really important little thing, but it's easily encompassed, the pain of separation. Here's the Buddha's awakening. Here's our conditioning. When we fall into the conditioned self and other, we suffer and cause suffering. When we can see ourselves doing that, we can start to move out of it. And every little inch of a move out of that opens us more to the possibility of the opening into that vast, loving intimacy that is what the Buddha and others have experienced. The other obstacle, this is a little separate, but related to low self-esteem or self-criticism, the Dharma does give the impression sometimes that you're just a regular practitioner sitting and sitting and sitting and sitting, and eventually, suddenly there's this angel that bops you on the top of the head, and then you're awake. That might happen for some people. I haven't met them. So it's a slow process. And my teacher said, if you really want to know what it's like, and I've said this to you before, sit outside or in front of a picture window, starting in the middle of the night on the darkest night of the year, or at least the darkest time of night, and sit there and watch the light gather. That's how we wake up. Imperceptible. So let's sit in a circle and do kind of a, you're kind of in a circle now, but let's make it just like a circle we're sitting and meditating in.
That's as far as that's
those of you who have been with us for the last couple months, I think it's cool to take a little time at the end, have a short talk, and then have a little time to talk about meditation. There's a couple of reasons for this. Sometimes the more years we meditate, the more we get confused about what meditation is. Or, on the other hand, we get so certain about what it is that we paint ourselves into a corner. Or sometimes meditation becomes rote. Or sometimes meditation gets really cluttered. Now, hopefully none of you have had any of that happen to you. But just in case it has, what is good to do is to take fresh looks at meditation sometimes. If you're completely happy with your meditation practice, don't change a thing. But the words that I'll say tonight are just a way, these are options for keeping your meditation fresh, keeping it uncluttered, keeping it from being rote. So if we look at the bare, and while I'm talking, why don't you pretend that you can meditate without, even though I'm talking. And so I would suggest that if you're an experienced meditator, at times practice meditating with your eyes open. The rationale for this is that it certainly keeps meditation fresh, and it also makes it easier to transition your meditation into daily life. And I'm not saying it's better to meditate with your eyes open, but there are some advantages to having some practice with it. So as you're sitting there with eyes half open, maybe looking at the floor a comfortable distance from you, if you like, the bare bones of meditation, just absolute bare bones, can be formulated as be here now, notice when you're not, return with kindness. Be here now, notice when you're not, return with kindness. Now you'll notice that this leaves out some things that you've been taught about meditation before. One of them is having an object for your meditation. And in our tradition, we usually use the breath. And this is something that you can recruit at any time. If you're having a bad day, if you're really distracted, if you can't keep your mind in one spot, in this kind of formless meditation I just described, then having an object, such as the breath, and the breath is the most handy one, is a great way of centering yourself. And it's certainly where beginners should begin. And then at times when meditation is really going smoothly, you can drop the breath in the sense of it's no more important than everything else that's arising to your eyes, to your ears, to all of your sensations, including your thoughts. Thoughts arise like everything else. Notice when you've been taken away, return with kindness. Now you notice that the other thing that's missing from that bare bones description of meditation is mindfulness. But every single step here now requires mindfulness. Notice when you're not, more clearly contains mindfulness. And return with kindness also requires mindfulness. So this is the bare bones of mindfulness meditation. In fact, there's no meditation that is without mindfulness. Now, if you're not having an object and you're being equally mindful of everything that arises, this has been called formless meditation. And you can be resting in that as long as is comfortable. And if you start to get kind of cramped about that, sometimes the mind gets kind of narrowed down too much or feels too narrow, too cramped, then there are ways of expanding the field. So can somebody put a little object on the floor in the middle of that circle? So instead of breath, we'll use that object as the anchor for your meditation. And so what we'll do now is try with mindfulness to keep your attention solely on that object. Of course, you'll be aware of other things, but that's the primary focus of your meditation right now, keeping your mind on that object. And when your mind slips away, you bring it back. Now, that's called shamatha, or in this tradition, it's called concentration practice, where you're consciously trying to keep your mind locked on one object. And there are forms of meditation that stop there. Concentration practices occupy a large part of some traditions. But now, while you're concentrating on that thing in the middle of the circle, there's a part of you that notices you're concentrating on it. You have the insight that there is a process of concentration going on. So that's the first level of insight meditation. You're not just becoming that object, but you notice that you're concentrating on that object. So the field is a little bigger. And then one can expand the field further. You can actually have a step back, seeing yourself, noticing that you're concentrating on that object. And each level of that little insight that you are being aware, that you are being mindful, that you are concentrating, is what they call Vipassana meditation or insight meditation. And insights flow from there. Another way of doing that is when you're staring at that object. Well, let's forget the object for now. Let's just go back to following your breath in and out. And then slowly shifting your attention to the out-breath, letting your attention ride the breath as it flows out. Until your whole consciousness seems to be on riding the out-breath, your attention riding the out-breath. And then slowly shift your attention away from the breath altogether to the expanding awareness itself, to the sense of a very expansive consciousness. So here you've expanded the meditation field. And if you've been feeling really cramped down on whatever has been your meditative focus, this is one way of expanding it. Now let's just go back to the be here now. Notice when you're not. And return with kindness. And the other big thing about meditation is that some traditions emphasize just returning. When you notice you're lost to distraction, you just return. And other traditions stress letting go of what carried you away and returning. And Zen really focuses on the letting go part. One way or the other, you be here now. Notice when you're not. Let go of what took you away and return, or simply return. Let's have a few minutes of meditating quietly, eyes open or closed. Focus on your breath or simply be here now. In either case, notice when you're carried away. And either consciously let go of what carried you away and come back to being here now, or come back to your breath. or simply return without thinking about letting go. Or you can play with these various ways of doing it. See how they feel. Okay, now just slowly bring yourselves back to the room. And what I've tried to do tonight is to give you ways of keeping meditation fresh. When you're really lost, having an anchor like the breath, or a rock in the middle of the room can be really helpful, or a picture, or a recitation, some anchor. When you're really cruising, as people with experience in meditation practice without that, it's a bit more expanded. If you're feeling like you have a hard time expanding, follow the breath out and let it carry the consciousness into a more expanded state. Focus on letting go or not. The outcome is the same. And above all else, return with kindness. No self-criticism, because that would be harm doing. No sense of failure, because that would be harm doing. We're here to do the opposite of harm. Oh, this was a meditation session in which I got lost a lot. Maybe I should have had more focus on the breath. Or when it's really bad, maybe I should take a cold shower and try again later. But self-kindness is the way we practice loving kindness for all. And there's no better place to focus on it than in meditation, because our conditioned tendency is to criticize ourselves. Now, there's an alchemical reaction in meditation. If you are meditating, even if you feel like you're having no insights at all, you are being changed by this practice. Because whether you are conscious of it or not, you are training your entire system, body, heart, and mind, to let go of fixations, to let go of whatever, concepts, attachments, aversions, without even thinking about it, just by continually coming back, or by thinking of letting go and coming back. Your system is being trained to not hold so tightly to the things we, in our conditioned way, hold to. So even when we think that nothing is happening in meditation, we're wrong. We are being changed, like the contents of an alchemist's crucible. Meditation is the process which heats this crucible up to the point that things inside are changing, namely us. And we are less tightly bound by the fixations of our conditioned existence, even if we don't realize it's happening. So there's no such thing as wasted meditation, unless you gleefully spend the whole time running a comic book in your head and don't ever come back. Then it's not meditation. It's just having a good time. And you're welcome to that too. Just make sure you see the difference. Any questions?
Well, can you use that? Hi, Terry. Can you use that comic book as your object of meditation?
Wow. You're a better woman than I am.
or something.
Yeah, anything can be the object. The thing about your favorite comic book or your favorite movie or favorite series.
Mantra. I mean, where's the difference between it might be mantra or it might be just whatever that you're really staying.
Great question. Great question. The mantra tends to keep us focused on a narrow band. Even if it's a long mantra, it's usually related to a single theme. Like the 100-syllable mantra in Tibetan Buddhism is all about a practice of confession and purification. So you're right there in that very focused band. So it's focused. The comic book just keeps going chapter after chapter after chapter, and it's thrilling, and it's just a recapitulation of ordinary life. If it weren't, it wouldn't sell. It's just ordinary life dressed up, ordinary dramas, ordinary attachments and aversions dressed up. If you're a really advanced practitioner, like if you're a Buddha, you could read a comic book without being lost to it. Mm-hmm. It would be like watching a movie from start to finish as if you were the film editor, not giving a damn about the content,
right?
Not being lost to any of it. Then it would work. Right. Then that would be meditation.
That's a little bit what I think I was getting at. That not that you're lost to the comic, but you're using that truly as that object of attention without being lost in it.
Yeah, anything that you can use as an object of attention without being lost is good. But once you're an experienced meditator, try formless meditation. Equal appreciation of everything, to every sense, simultaneously. Just being present.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're going to be advanced enough to hold a comic book chapter as your object of meditation.
I'm not saying I am.
But if you were, then why not just sit in formless meditation and have everything?
Right.
The rattling dishes, the horn, the people talking outside, the runny nose, all of it equal as presence.
Sure.
That's the difference. I hope I answered your question, because it's a really good question.
Can I say just one other thing? Was I like that idea of the more Zen way of acknowledging what you're letting go of. And it reminded me of the investigation in Rain, that there's just that little bit of a, oh, that's what I'm letting go of.
Mm-hmm.
There's that thought of letting go of. And it's a little more investigative, yeah?
Yes, and that is both the benefit and the threat of it, because there is a difference between meditation and investigation. Investigation gets more into a story, whereas in meditation in this way, we're just noticing what's arising and letting it go.
But not in that RAIN acronym.
Not in that. That would be more in activity. Uh-huh. Using RAIN. Not that you can't do it in meditation, it's just that if we're looking at that Zen kind of meditation where we're letting go, we're not really investigating or analyzing or doing any kind of introspection. We're just letting go.
What I've been trying to do lately, this is too much talking, is when I notice a thought, I try to bring it out of my mind before I let go of it. I bring it from my mind into my heart, and then I let go of it.
How's that working?
Well, I feel as if I acknowledge something, whether I'm just lost and in delusion, I acknowledge myself with kind, it's like that kindness step. I acknowledge myself and then I go back to the breath. Or if I'm caught in a negative loop about something, I acknowledge maybe that person with kindness and then go back to my, and that feels, it just feels as if I've it feels better. It feels like a kindness that I've turned my negative into a kindness, and it makes me feel better. And it's almost like a blessing to that person.
That sounds beautiful, Carol.
Anyway, I like it.
Yeah, and the risk would be spinning off into a story about that.
Of course.
You catch yourself doing that and come back.
Right, I see that, but yeah.
And that's not bad either. I mean, that too is allowing you to notice where we spin off and then gently come back with kindness. Yeah.
Right. It helps that kindness part, that kindness piece you talked about.
It's crucial. It's non-harming, moment by moment by moment, non-harming. We're also going to practice it that frequently, except in our meditation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are great questions. And mantra is fine. And in fact, as Carol was implying, in what she learns by looking at it and letting it go, mantra can have the same thing. Mantra can imbue you with the qualities of that mantra. Like if you're doing mantra for a bodhisattva of compassion, or doing mantra for a confession practice, or doing mantra for a removal of obstacles practice, you're infused with those kinds of blessings as you have it rise up and then go away. Rise up, let go, come back. You're being infused with that particular flavor. Mm-hmm. But that can be a very distracting practice too, and you can get lost into a storyline about that. We can get lost into a storyline about anything. But Carol's giving us a good example of being with playing with different things in meditation. You're all experienced enough to know when you're just lost in the comic book and you're lost to it and you're enjoying it and you don't want to come back to meditation. We can recognize that. And we can practice with other things. And one cool thing to practice with is this formless meditation, where we're holding everything that comes into every sense equally, and with an equally light touch, just as with the breath, and letting it go and coming back to presence. Thanks, Carol. And again, it can be really helpful to have times when you practice with your eyes open. Several benefits there. Keeps meditation fresh when it's becoming unfresh. If you're getting drowsy, it can freshen it up a little bit. And it can also help it be broader, bigger field. And it also, as I said before, helps you take meditation out onto the road. So you can be meditating while you're waiting for the plane or waiting for the bus or in the Safeway line. Your eyes will be open, and it might only be a 1 minute meditation, but you can return to that being present, noticing when you're distracted and carried away, coming back. Why do it in the Safeway line? Well, you're less likely to be in a hurry, and it's just one more moment of practice with that alchemical principle, that every time we notice we're lost to something, let it go and come back, we are being transformed. We are less conditioned. The Dharma is all about deconditioning. Every time we let go and come back, or just come back with kindness, we're deconditioning. That's Dharma. Even though we don't know what's happening to us. It's really cool. Any other questions?
I have one, Terry.
Yeah.
Back a while ago, you mentioned about the four preliminaries, and one of your teachers way back said something about you needed to focus on them for 2 years before he would accept you as a student. And since you said that, I've been trying to remember the four preliminaries every day. Now I don't have to remember them anymore. They just keep popping up.
Yeah.
Never know when, but they just keep coming up over and over again. And that kind of breaks the spell, if you will.
Can you say more about that?
Well, you know, we talk about the mind. I call it daydreaming, where the mind all of a sudden just carries you off and you're in la-la land. That's my term. And all of a sudden, the four preliminaries come up. And it brings me back to being here. So I focus on the four preliminaries and just spend a little time with each of them. And then I'm here. And that, you know, I can't tell you how many times a day it happens, but the more I do it, the more it happens. So I don't know what more to say.
Huh. Well, that's a lot. Yeah, my experience has been similar, Rick. It becomes less and less of a formal recitation and more of just, oh yeah, I am so lucky to be in the Dharma and have these circumstances to practice. And oh yeah, this opportunity won't last long. Everything is changing as I look at it. And everything, I start to get the feeling that I'm really responsible for everything I do and say because it has effects. And then I also start to have my heart broken open with compassion for all the people who will never be exposed to these teachings, or even if they were, don't have the circumstances to study and practice. So it's transformative. And I do recommend them strongly.
Is exactly what's happening to me.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's thank you so much for that description, because it's hard to believe when those are first presented to you that they can do anything. These four little thoughts that seem archaic. But make them your own and rewrite them for yourself when they get stale and they help. And I think on the flyer for the March retreat, we put a line in that reciting those, contemplating those regularly would be a help on the retreat. So for those of you who are planning to come to the retreat, I encourage you to do it if it wasn't in the brochure. And if you're not planning on coming to the retreat, I even more encourage you to do it, because then it'll make it easier for you to share the fruits of the retreat with those who go. I think the retreat this year will be a little different. Less talking and more opportunity to practice in various ways, including times with less structure, I hope. We'll play it by ear. But retreat is actually an opportunity. In fact, Robert Thurman, Uma Thurman's dad, said that retreat is vacation. And I'd like to have this March retreat be more like vacation, where we have this opportunity, this rare opportunity, to simply sink into the Dharma and follow various practice leads and work on various approaches and not have anything else to do. Somebody else will feed you. Somebody will give you a room. Somebody will tell you which direction is the toilet, and all you need to do is practice.
Nice.
Okay. Wonderful to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
See you soon.
And each of you, by being a Dharma practitioner in the Sangha and a Sangha member, is also a teacher. Feel free to share things that are meaningful to you with other Sangha members who couldn't make it. That's how we support each other. Okay.
All right. Good night.
Safe travels. Get home safely.
Hey,
good
night. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Okay.